Good morning. So happy to be here and to have an opportunity to speak with you this morning. First of all, I'd like for you to picture with me a graduation day. This is actually my graduation day, many years ago. It was a rainy day, but it was a happy day. We were celebrating. My friends and I wore shiny blue caps and gowns. Our tassels swayed in the wind, and our eyes shone as we looked toward a bright future ahead of us. Because it was a rainy day, colorful umbrellas bobbed like party balloons through a crowd of family, friends, and faculty, boosting the festive atmosphere. No more school, I kept telling myself. And I was wrong because I went back to school later. But at the time, that was my thought. No more school. No more tests, papers, or grades. I had my college degree in hand. It was time to do something with it. I had a job lined up. I was actually a newlywed. I was already settled in my apartment with my husband. And the future felt like a wide open door to a new country. My husband was with me that day. He was cheering me on as I had done for him at his graduation 2 years earlier. My best friends were there. Many of them were in the same graduating class with me. So they were celebrating and making plans of their own as well. My parents were there. They had driven 500 miles to celebrate with us and show their pride in another college graduate in the family. And in spite of the rain that day, we all smiled, we snapped photos, and we pinched ourselves to make sure we'd really made it this far. But all that day, in the midst of the celebration and the joy, I remember feeling troubled and anxious. And this was because while I tried to ignore it, I couldn't help but notice a familiar, faraway look on my mom's face. A stiff half smile on her lips that showed she was trying to engage with the rest of us, but that she was not really there with us, not fully there. I had spent my teenage years trying, but I had never been able to escape the emotional devastation of seeing that look on my mom's face, because I knew very clearly what it meant. And I had become very sensitive to my mom's moods and the looks on her faces. So I knew that that look meant that sometime soon, perhaps very soon, we would lose her again. I was right about that. Actually, the next morning, after graduating and celebrating with friends, my husband and I got out of bed and went out into the rest of our apartment. My parents had stayed with us overnight, and we went out to spend some time with them before they left for home. We found my dad hovering over Mom. She lay where she had slept, and he was trying to rouse her. She was awake, but she was catatonic. She was non-responsive. Well, we had been through this before. So after about an hour of gentle and persistent work, she began responding to our insistence that she engage with reality. We walked her through the basics. Open your eyes. See if you can move your arms. Try moving your legs. Sit up. Slowly, step by step, she revived, and eventually she shuffled her way to the car. My parents drove home, and a day or two later, my dad called to say Mom was back in the hospital. Now, we weren't surprised when we heard this news, but we did grieve, as we had done so many times before, and as we would do so many more times, experiencing the same kind of grief. Once again, schizophrenia had stolen the precious person who gently cared for me when I was sick, held me when I was sad, and taught me about God. Her symptoms came in cycles and waves, as they do for most people who have this devastating disease. And this particular wave cast a shadow over a new stage in my life. After the joy of getting married, graduating from college, landing my first career job, that long process of gradually leaving home, I found suddenly that I could not really leave the grief of repeatedly losing my mom to delusions, paranoia, and incapacitation. Well, my mom's illness began a long time ago. It began before I was born, but it turned our lives upside down when I was 14 years old. Although we needed years to really understand what had happened at that point, life would never be the same after she suffered her first fully incapacitating psychotic break. She had been having psychotic episodes for years. She had not been healthy for a long time. But her disorder grew until it fully blossomed, and at that point, when I was 14, made her completely unable to discern reality. Well, she was hospitalized multiple times when I was in high school, and each time she returned home with bottles of pills that controlled most of her symptoms. They really helped, but they made her miserable with their side effects, and she hated taking them. But she would take them anyway because she felt so bad, and she'd sit on the couch staring into space, and then eventually she'd start feeling better, and she'd start shuffling around the house and doing what she could to care for her family. And eventually, when she started really feeling a lot better, eventually, at some point, she would decide she didn't need to take those pills anymore. So she wouldn't. And the cycle would repeat itself, and we learned to live without her. When she was home, we cared for her, and we let her care for us the best she could, because it seemed important to her, and it was important to all of us to have some semblance of normalcy in our home. But we didn't really have the luxury of needing her anymore, so we didn't. Neither did we have the luxury of seeking sympathy or support in the people around us. We knew, as everyone did, that we were not supposed to talk about mental illness. We got the message that we were alone, that no one would understand, that we were worthy of shame, and we were supposed to pretend everything was fine and somehow keep it all under control, mostly for the sake of the people around us. So that's what we tried to do. And nowhere was this more true for us than at church. For the most part, our church seemed content with this arrangement because they were very quiet too. I had been in the church my whole life. My dad was a pastor for 10 years when I was growing up. At this point, he was not, but we were very engaged lay people. My family was very involved in the church, and I had never heard a sermon that mentioned mental illness. No one had addressed it in Sunday school or youth group, and I had the distinct impression that the church was actually afraid of the questions I most needed to ask. Questions like, what was happening to my mom? Why my good Christian family was suffering, and why God didn't fix it. And my Christian college campus wasn't much different, actually. I just didn't feel safe talking with anyone about my family's pain or my own. And frankly, I'm not sure I would have known how. How to talk about it, how to bring it up, how to ask for what I needed. Well, as the years have marched on from there, my family has continued to walk through decades that have brought a string of run-ins with the harsh effects of my mom's disease. Some of the worst things that happen to people who have schizophrenia and those who love them. Difficult and broken relationships, paranoid fear, many hospitalizations, public embarrassment, religious confusion, occult activities, homelessness, danger, arrest and conviction, and prison time. Periods of stability and hope, followed by another slow or sometimes sudden loss of the person we know and love. Battles with shame and stigma that kept us quiet and isolated even from each other for decades, as we all tried to do to cope in the best ways we knew how. Battles for the life and well-being of a woman we cherish, who still has a purpose and a place in this world. Like most churches and Christian communities, our church and my college campus were both full of good, well-intentioned people. And yet these people allowed fear, misunderstanding, and stigma to keep them from ministry to a suffering family, even the ministry of breaking silence. Unfortunately, in that sense, our story is not unique. And frankly, in many other ways, our story is not unique. Mental illness is far more common than most people realize. And while I'm talking about, in my own experience, about arguably the most severe form of mental illness, there are many other forms that mental illness takes. And many people, even if they struggle with a more common disorder like depression or an anxiety disorder, can experience some of these same things. But we don't have to keep making these kinds of mistakes. Staying silent about our trouble or staying silent about these issues that affect people so profoundly. Most people, including most pastors and other church leaders, have no idea that in the United States, the number one frontline mental health care resource is churches. Historically speaking, and these statistics are from the National Institutes of Mental Health, when people have sought treatment or help for mental illness, 25% of them have gone first to a member of the clergy. 16% have gone to a psychiatrist, 16% to a general medical doctor, and the numbers go down from there. 25% is the highest percentage, and clergy are the number one place people are going for help. And in the United States, that means mostly we're talking about churches. And this statistic is true for people who don't consider themselves actively religious. This is not just for people who are involved in faith communities. Society-wide, clergy are the number one mental health resource. So, with so many opportunities to help people in need, how shall we respond? Well, it begins with a better understanding. We need a better understanding of mental illness, and unfortunately, there are many myths around mental illness in our society and even particularly within our churches and our other Christian communities like this college campus. Mental illness is highly misunderstood and misinterpreted. And if we want to help and support people affected by such illness, and if we want to advocate for help when we need it, we need the firm footing of an accurate understanding. So there's a lot we need to learn. But for starters, here are 8 basic things we should all know. And these are specifically designed to contradict some of the myths that are out there in our communities. 1, mental illness happens to the best of us. If you pay attention, as I do, you can find countless examples of faithful Christian people whose families are affected by mental illness. You can find stories of the news about this nearly every week. Many of them are pastors or missionaries. Some have donated large sums to charity, have done good work to help people worldwide. Many of us have the mistaken belief that such people should not suffer or will not suffer, at least not with the kinds of tragedies that mental illness and suicide represent. But the truth is, mental illness strikes all kinds of people. Being a good person, being a good parent, being a Christian, going to college, all of these things bring joys of their own, but none of them will ensure that mental illness doesn't strike you or your family. 2, Jesus does not promise to prevent or cure our ailments in this life. A misunderstanding of Christian belief sometimes causes people to ask questions like, well, what good is Jesus if this is what happens to his followers? Or if God loves me, why doesn't he heal me? Why doesn't he take this away? The truth is, Jesus promised us trouble in this life. And you can look it up in John 16:33. Christian theology teaches that we are not immune to suffering of any kind. Christians are as affected as anyone else by the curse that is on this world. But Christ does redeem our suffering, and one day he will make us new, with new bodies that don't decay, minds that don't get sick, and spirits that don't lose heart. We have great hope in this life and for the next, but that doesn't mean that he'll take all of our suffering away. 3, mental illness doesn't mean God doesn't love you or you haven't done enough for him. Mental illness is not anyone's fault, unless you want to say it's everyone's fault, yours and mine. It's a fact of life in this world because of sin. We live in a tainted world, in a sin-sick world. It's a fact of life in a world that is deeply twisted by rebellion against God. So you could say it's everyone's fault, but it's not an individual person's fault. As the Apostle Paul assures us, having trouble, even the very worst kinds of trouble, does not mean God has abandoned us. And you can look that one up in Romans 8:35 through 38. If death itself can't separate you from the love of God, I know mental illness can't either. Good behavior and serving God are not magical charms that will make our problems go away. We do not hold the remedy for our infirmity. Christ does, and he has not yet fully unleashed it on the world. God loves every single one of us and grieves with us in our suffering. So if you experience mental illness, please know this is not a punishment from God. It's not an indication that God has walked away from you. He loves you, and he cares for you in your suffering. Mental illness is real, and it must be taken seriously. I travel around and I speak on this topic a lot. Obviously, I've done a lot of writing on this topic. I hear so many stories from people, and I continue to be baffled and troubled by how common it is within Christian communities to hear teaching that suggests mental illness is not a real medical condition, or that it simply reflects a spiritual problem or a behavioral problem that needs to be corrected. For example, you know, you don't have enough faith, or you don't pray enough, or you don't read the Bible enough. We would never tolerate the widespread teaching of this kind of perspective on cancer, diabetes, broken legs. Families of people who have suffered with serious and chronic mental illness know better than this. We have seen what mental illness does to our loved ones. Brain injuries and chemical problems are real, documented, and treatable. And while spiritual practices can provide comfort, they can facilitate health for people, they do not provide the treatment that people with acute suffering need. Mental illnesses are like other afflictions. They require expert attention and treatment. And sometimes that means therapy. Sometimes it means medication, at least for a short time. It might mean a hospitalization. Sometimes all three of those things. It almost always means lifestyle changes and spiritual care as part of the mix. But ignoring an illness or discouraging people from seeking treatment does not make it go away. And sometimes getting treatment really is a matter of life and death. We can't expect people to just shake it off. Again, we have many misconceptions about what it means to suffer from mental illness. People who've never suffered from clinical depression, for example, often find it hard to understand why depressed people might struggle to get out of bed, why they might struggle to eat or sleep, go to work, why they might desperately want to end their lives at times. People who don't have these symptoms might mistake them for things they have experienced, like a simple lack of initiative or self-pity or a case of the blues. But just as a person can't will away a case of diabetes, a person with serious mental illness doesn't just get over it either because they decide to. Treatment doesn't necessarily equal cure. With remarkable advances in brain science, psychology, and medications, mental illnesses actually have become highly treatable conditions. Treatments for some mental illnesses are up to 90% effective when people receive treatment, which is only about 50% of the time in the U.S. But that doesn't mean 90% of people are cured. For many people, successful treatment means daily medication, ongoing therapy, learning to take special care to manage a chronic condition. For a lot of people, symptoms are cyclical, as they are for my mom. So a person who's healthy most of the time can suddenly have serious symptoms return, requiring a hospital stay, an adjustment to medication, or some kind of other intervention. So if you know someone who has received treatment for a mental illness, please don't assume that person's troubles are over just because they're receiving treatment. And try to be patient with them as they need ongoing support. That is simply the nature of much mental illness. Sometimes treatment isn't enough, and it's important to acknowledge that, because sometimes people use a failed treatment as an excuse to illegitimize all forms of mental health treatment. Despite the best efforts of loved ones and mental health professionals, sometimes fighting mental illness is a losing battle. That doesn't mean the treatments and support are illegitimate. It simply means our best efforts don't always save the people we want to save. And this is the case with any form of health problem. This is always tragic, but it's a reality we must live with, and it doesn't mean we ought to give up on trying to save those we can. Number 8, families need support. We're all surrounded by families who are struggling to care for loved ones affected by mental illness. You might be surrounded by people on this campus who are trying to make sense of a difficult experience related to mental health, either their own or that of someone in their family. From experience, I know mental illness creates crisis within families, often leaves people completely overwhelmed. And on top of that, our mental health care system can be extremely difficult to navigate. Medications, therapy, and hospitalizations can be impossibly expensive. Dealing with a repeating cycle of symptoms can mean putting life on hold again and again for families. And adjusting to the chronic nature of some illness means letting go of cherished dreams and visions for a loved one's future. Families need the help of loving communities who are not too scared to talk about mental illness, too impatient to stick with them, or too weary to help again and again when it's needed. It's important to acknowledge that this kind of loving ministry is what the church is here for. This is part of why we're here. Responding to mental illness is not just a nice thing to do. It's not just an idea that will make us popular with people who like to see the church doing some good in this world. Loving people affected by mental illness is part of our mission as the church. And this is true not only for church leaders, but also for every Christian. This is also a tremendous outreach opportunity. People are coming to the church for help in suffering, and even a small light can make a big difference in a dark place. Through our loving response, we actually carry the light of Christ with us. As the body of Christ and an instrument of God's communication with the world, the church must, as Luke 6:31 tells us in the words of Jesus, do to others as you would like them to do to you. Colossians 3:11 tells us we're called to be a place where it doesn't matter if you are a Jew or a Gentile, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbaric, uncivilized, slave or free. I would add mentally healthy or not, and all of the other things that seem to divide us from one another. Christ is all that matters, and he lives in all of us. This is supposed to be a place where Philippians 2:2 tells us we are agreeing wholeheartedly with each other, loving each other, and working together with one mind and purpose. A church like this will care deeply about everyone in their ranks, welcome hurting people, and refuse to turn away from suffering. In Colossians 3:12 through 17, the Apostle Paul wrote one portion of what I like to call the church's mission statement, part of what tells us what we're here for. And among this set of instructions, Paul calls the church to clothe yourselves with tender-hearted mercy, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Make allowance for each other's faults. And he says, clothe yourselves with love. Is this the way your community sees its mission? Is this the way you behave? Do you make allowance for each other's faults? Clothe yourselves with love so that love is actually the first thing people see when they look at you. A church that takes this mission seriously can't ignore or reject 20% of the population simply because they have an illness, injury, or disorder that happens to affect their brains, rather than another physical organ we're more comfortable dealing with. And in 1 Corinthians 12:22 through 26, Paul wrote another passage that builds on the metaphor for the church as Christ's body, making special mention of those parts of the body that we are tempted to ignore or hide. He writes, in fact, some parts of the body that seem weakest and least important are actually the most necessary. And the parts we regard as less honorable are those we clothe with the greatest care. So we carefully protect those parts that should not be seen, while the more honorable parts do not require this special care. God has put the body together such that extra honor and care are given to those parts that have less dignity. This makes for harmony among the members so that all the members care for each other. If one part suffers, all the parts suffer with it. And if one part is honored, all the parts are glad. Does this passage describe your church or your Christian college community, which is a part of the church? Or your approach to suffering people? Do you take extra care for those members who have less dignity? If one person suffers, do you all suffer? We can make our communities safer places to suffer. There's plenty we can do to help, plenty we can do to support people affected by mental illness. Some are called to do something requiring a big investment. Others are simply required to love others in small ways. And I would say that's true for all of us, at least to some degree. Here are some ways, big and small, that we can pursue our calling in relationship to people affected by mental illness. And I want to just say that it starts not with what we do, but with the way we think, with what we believe, with our theology and our anthropology, our beliefs about God and our beliefs about ourselves and one another and our responsibility to each other. So the first thing I would say we must do is to acknowledge universal human brokenness. This is Christian doctrine at its most basic, but we sometimes forget to walk in the humility of the knowledge that we are all flawed and scarred and in need. And we think, you know, some of us have it together and others among us are broken, but we're all broken and we're all in need. And when we start there, we automatically begin to make our communities safer to suffer. Number two, we need to learn and teach about suffering, and I'd say that specifically within the context of Christian theology. We need to contradict the idea that we should expect an easy or pain-free life on this earth. When people among us experience suffering, they should not be surprised by it. They shouldn't suffer the secondary crisis of wondering if God has turned his back on them because they're suffering. If we allow people to be surprised by suffering, we've let them down. Or if we haven't given them a context for how suffering fits into the Christian life, we need to do that. Number three, treat people like people. This sounds very simple, but people with significant mental health problems often walk around feeling like walking illnesses because their illness is the first thing people see about them or the only thing they care about them. But people with mental health problems are people. They are people before they are ill people. People with significant mental health problems may struggle to pretend everything is fine. You and I may have an easier time pretending everything is fine. That doesn't mean everything's always fine for us either, but we can maybe hide it better. And because people with mental health problems may have a hard time pretending, you may want to avoid them for this reason. They might make you feel uncomfortable. But I encourage you to get past that, to see the person in front of you, to make eye contact, to smile, to say hello, to refuse to succumb to irrational fear. Now, there is a place for rational fear. If someone presents a danger to themselves or to other people, there's a place for rational fear and for seeking help to deal with that emergency situation. But the vast majority of the time, that's not happening. Our fear of others is really irrational. And I encourage you to recognize there's a real and suffering person present. Number four, offer friendship. We often think we're not qualified to help with mental illness because maybe we aren't psychiatrists or we don't have degrees in counseling. And yet everyone is qualified to do this. Everyone can be a friend. And this is one of the most valuable and important things we can offer. Do what you already know how to do. Christian communities are great at this. We're great at helping people, making sure they have what they need, coming together to offer meals or offer rides or simply offer a listening ear when someone is in need. And yet we often forget to do these things or seem to forget how to do these things when someone is affected by a mental health problem. And that's why mental illness is often referred to as the no casserole illness. Because if someone in your family is experiencing depression or has been hospitalized for a mental health problem, there's a slim chance anyone's going to be dropping by with a casserole that evening. People tend to pull back rather than pull toward. So pull toward the people around you and do what you already know how to do. We can provide meals and rides. We can visit them in the hospital, take care of their kids or their pets, do their laundry, help with expenses, ask how they're feeling, ask how their treatment's coming along, ask what they need, and be willing to help. Number six, talk about mental illness. We need to mention it in the sermons in our churches. We need to mention it in our classes, our Bible studies, our prayers. We need to just get it out there that this exists. We recognize it exists among us. We know people are suffering, and we care enough to lift them up before God. Number seven, refer to mental health professionals. If you're involved in a church, I encourage you to encourage that church's leaders to build a network of local professionals and make it widely available so that when somebody is in need, they know the church is a place they can go for referrals to outside care to help them navigate that healthcare system that most people don't know about until they need it. And when they need it, that's a really hard time to try to navigate that system. But referral isn't good enough. I can't stress partnership enough. Churches and mental health professionals need to work together. And as the church, we need to learn from them and have them train us and support us. And if you refer someone to mental health care, if you tell someone to go to the counseling center here on campus, or you send somebody to talk to somebody in the community, that's not an excuse to abandon them. and to leave them to their own devices. They still need friendship. They still need love and care and community. So be the church. That's number 8. Recognize that professional mental health care is not a substitute for the social support, spiritual care, and loving community that we can provide. And be willing to provide that. Number 9, start a ministry. You can start a support group or any other kind of mental health ministry, and there are resources out there to help your church do that. You can check out the Mental Health Grace Alliance, a ministry called Fresh Hope for Mental Health. There's NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and they work with faith-based organizations all the time. There's mental health first aid. I think every church in America ought to have at least one person who is trained in mental health first aid and knows how to act as a first responder in a mental health crisis. In a church, this does not have to be a ministry that the pastor personally oversees. Someone who cares about this issue within the church can be the go-to or point person for this. Loving people affected by mental illness is part of our mission. It's part of our work as the people of God. This is our calling. I wrote my book, Troubled Minds, to help the church better understand the needs of people affected by mental illness, not just my family, but lots of other people who have stories like ours. I also wrote it to challenge the church, and I want to be clear that the church is not pastors, it's not church leaders, it's all of us who follow Jesus. It's everyone who belongs to Christian community. I wanted to challenge us to see this as part of our mission in this life. Is there any ministry more fitting for people who follow Jesus? In Jesus' ministry on earth, no one was outside the margins of his notice. No one was unworthy of his attention, too sick for his healing, or too dirty for his touch. Jesus loved to surprise those who were usually ignored and marginalized by noticing them and ministering to them. He loved to heal the ones everybody thought were beyond hope. He taught us, God blesses those who are poor and realize their need for him, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Those who most acutely feel their need for God are blessed in his eyes, and we are blessed as we serve them. God's heart is open toward those who are open to him. Christ came to save those who were aware of their need, and we are also called to people in need. This is our calling. Let's embrace our calling and shine the light of Christ in the darkness. Loving people affected by mental illness is part of our mission. It's a great fit with the reason we're here. A couple of years ago, my mom was coming off of a severe mental health crisis. She had been hospitalized multiple times in a short space of time. She was very psychotic, very delusional, and really and paranoid, really living in fear. And she was not well enough to be at home, yet she wasn't, the hospital wouldn't keep her either. So, because our insurance company wouldn't pay for very long. So this is a dilemma a lot of people find themselves in. And so anyway, ultimately we had her released into a secure assisted living facility. This was a memory care facility that was set up to care for people with Alzheimer's disease, with dementia, in their old age. And while my mom's illness is, obviously it's not one of those illnesses, it's different, yet they were equipped to help care for severely ill people, and they agreed to allow her to come and live there, at least as long as she needed to. So we were tremendously grateful for this place that had given my mom a home and a safe place to begin to recover from this latest episode of severe mental illness. When my mom went there, she didn't know her own name. She was very delusional. She was pretty much completely unaware of reality. She was very fearful. She was too afraid to sleep in her own room by herself at night because of the things she imagined might happen. And so the gracious people in this place allowed her to sleep wherever she wanted to. And she chose to sleep on a bench outside the doors to the chapel. Well, when my family was in town for Christmas, we went to visit her in this place. And I remember walking in through the doors to go visit her and thinking about how grateful I was that they had given her this home, that they had cared for her, that they were gracious and generous with her, and that they had that she had gotten a lot better while she was living there because of this care. So we were just really grateful for the ways God had used this place to minister to my mom and by extension to my family. Well, while we were there, my mom decided to introduce us to some of her friends that she'd made while she was there, some of the people she hung out with. So she took us among them. She took us to the room of this particular gentleman who ate a lot of meals with my mom. And he invited us in, and he was kind of showing us around the place and telling us about his family. And he had a beautiful dog, and we got to introduce to his dog. But he started telling us and kind of surprised us by telling us about the tremendous influence my mom had had in this place. She'd had this real influence on the other residents there. This man was not a person of faith, and he told us that, but he recognized that there was something different about my mom. He recognized the presence of Christ in her life. Because of her, he said, the other residents had more hope and joy in their lives. Because of her, people felt listened to. They felt like they had a friend because she would be a friend to them. And because my mom had made it for him, he had a Christmas ornament hanging in his apartment. It was simply an artistic rendering of the name Jesus. And it would not have been there if my mom hadn't been there. I will admit I was shocked by this revelation. I was so focused on the way the people there had cared for my mom and the way God had used this place to minister to us that it was not even on my radar screen that my mom might actually be doing ministry there. That even in her desperate condition, God could use her, and that he would, and that he did. And this changed the way I saw her, actually, and it changed the way I saw God and his work in people. I encourage you to take heart as I did and find hope in knowing mental illness does not make anyone marginal to God's plans. He is in the business of redemption. And regardless of how we may see people with mental illness or ourselves, he sees every single person for who we are and loves us all far more than we can imagine. In God's grace, we can extend that same kind of loving vision toward one another. We can see each other through the eyes of the Spirit, who helps us see the value and the potential in one another. This is the right posture for ministry to people affected by mental illness. It's the right posture for ministry to anybody, I think. Regardless of our mental health, we are all equally valuable in God's eyes, and all of Christ's followers have a place and a purpose in his kingdom. God has a purpose for everyone, and our limitations don't limit him. People with mental illness are precious to him, and they should be precious to the rest of us. Loving people affected by mental illness is part of our mission as the people of God, and I encourage you to take up that mission and to encourage your church to do the same. Thank you for your time this morning.